Hello. As the Philadelphia Orchestra opens its summer season, we speak with Rossin Milanoff, the group's artistic director at the Mann Center for the Performing Arts. Susan Lewis looks at Japanese Masters of the Brush, an exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art exploring the work of an 18th century husband and wife team. We visit the James A. Michener Art Museum. Jason Pfeiffer explores the theater scene on New Jersey's southernmost tip with visits to the Cape May Stage and the East Lynn Theater Company. And we pay a visit to the Marian Anderson Historical Residence and Museum. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Philadelphia Orchestra began its annual outdoor concert series earlier this week. It's the first full season as artistic director of the group at the Mann Center for Rossin Milanoff. Because many of the acts had already been booked when he was appointed, last year was largely unrepresentative of his curatorial vision. For this summer, however, Milanoff has made many changes to what the orchestra will perform. Out goes movie music, pops and jazz duties are now being handled by the Philly Pops, and the season as a whole will be more representative of what the orchestra performs in the winter, with standard repertoire and new works prominent. I spoke with Rossin Milanoff when he announced details of his plans for the Mann some weeks ago. Second season in charge, what did you learn from the first one?
We learned a lot of things. Of course, the most important thing this year is that we finally have the entire venue completed. Last year we were in the middle of the big renovation that was going on here at the Mann. Musically, of course, this year we had a lot more time to plan adequately. The season has a lot more of what my concept is actually for summer concerts of the Philadelphia Orchestra here at the Mann. As you look at the program, you'll see that we kept some of the ideas from last season. And what we thought was quite successful was the fact that we bring here at the Mann pieces that we associate very closely with the Philadelphia Orchestra. And this year, of course, we have a lot of that. Plus, we also felt that some of the artists that we normally don't have in our normal subscription seasons is always a good idea to invite here at the Mann. And we have Itzhak Perlman, of course, returning for a second year in a row to solo with us. We have artists such as Midori and Andrew Watts that are also making their appearances here that not necessarily have been part of the season or will be part of the season next year.
Tell me about some of the unusual things or some of the risks you're taking. There are a lot of very well-known, very, very popular pieces in your program. What were the things that you wanted people to know a little bit more about?
The quite unusual things compared to what we had last season, because if I could label the last season, it would have been probably one of the most conservative ones that we have done here at the Mann. This year we're getting a little more adventurous in a way that we'll be presenting some of the music that we premiered in recent years and that we thought that they became instant classics. And I'm here referring mostly to the very well-known Philadelphia composer Jennifer Higdon. We commissioned that piece, we premiered it with Maestro Savalich a few years ago, and since then it has become one of the most popular American works in the repertoire. And we thought that it would be wonderful to perform this piece again, since originally it was written for us. Then we have a special theme that is going to be the main focus on our second week at the Mann Center, and that's the theme East Meets West, with which we'll explore pieces that were influenced by the cultures of the East, and in most cases they will be even presented by artists that originally come from. So we thought that might be a very interesting idea that will bring connections not only to the music itself but also to a whole array of other aspects that goes very well with music, so that we could encourage people to learn more about those traditions, particularly now in times that it feels that the art could also help what's going on in our historical situation with this big conflict that's obviously happening between the Eastern and the Western cultures. I think this is a very good step for us to know our mutual traditions better.
Rossin Milanoff, Artistic Director of the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Center for the Performing Arts. The orchestra performs a free outdoor concert this evening at Pastorius Park in the Chestnut Hill section of Philadelphia before heading to Colorado for a series of three concerts at the Vail Valley Music Festival. The group returns to Philadelphia for a further six concerts at the Mann Center for the Performing Arts beginning July 18th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
From its beginnings, the Philadelphia Museum of Art has collected Asian art. The city and the museum in particular has maintained a relationship with Japan, evident in the reconstructed Japanese tea room in the museum's permanent collection, the Japanese house in West Fairmount Park, and the cherry blossoms that accent the cityscape each spring. This summer, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, in cooperation with the Tokyo National Museum and the Osaka Municipal Museum, is hosting an exhibition of Japanese art that would be difficult to replicate, even in Japan. Drawing from private and public collections from East and West, it gathers in one place many rarely seen works of two great 18th century Japanese artists. WRTI's Susan Lewis has more.
Philadelphia has connections with Japan that go back even before the art museum was founded. Museum director Ann Darnincourt says the relationship started with America's Centennial Exhibition in 1876.
In Philadelphia, for the first time in the United States, were gathered works of art from Asia and many things from Japan. People saw what a great opportunity it was to have a great international exhibition and project in the city, and they said, oh, well, in that case, we have to have an art museum.
In this new exhibition, the museum shows these works in a way that gives the visitor a taste of the holistic experience of viewing Japanese art, starting with a walk down a long hallway, its plum-colored walls accented by gray-tone vertical columns, but without other ornamentation or artwork. Museum curator of Japanese art, Felice Fisher, says that in Japanese culture, art is an activity in which the viewer participates.
Everything has to be unrolled, unfurled, unfolded to view. It's the anticipation and preparing yourself spiritually for what you're going to see. So it's not just something there to be viewed from a distance in awe in a frame on the wall.
Of course, in a museum, art hangs on the walls. But in these galleries, the jade-toned walls, the low lighting, and the delicate nature of much of the work creates a quiet, almost reverential ambiance. And to really see the art, you have to get up close. This intimacy gives you an opportunity to get to know Ike Taiga, described by Nobuyuki Minato, executive vice director of the Tokyo National Museum, as one of Japan's most influential masters.
Taiga is one of the most important Japanese artists, especially. He's the most famous literati painter, and his wife named Gyokuran is also a well-known female artist in the 18th century. Basically, a literati painter is not painting for the sake of making money, but for the sake of one's own pleasure.
Although painting in the literati style, Taiga did sell his work. Born in 1723 into a socially humble family, he showed signs of virtuosity at an early age. Curator Felice Fisher says it was his talent for calligraphy that first caught the attention of the learned class.
And he was fortunate in that when he was about six or seven, his very smart mother took him to temple near Kyoto where there were Chinese monks and calligraphers, and he did a calligraphy demonstration for them. And they said, this child is a prodigy, he's brilliant.
With the monks, Taiga studied calligraphy. From there, Japanese painting was a short brushstroke away, and by his early teens, Taiga became a working artist. At 14, he opened a fan shop to help support himself and his widowed mother. There, he came to the attention of wealthy patrons. By his mid-20s, he was a celebrity painter, known as a bit of an eccentric. He married Tokiyama Gyokuran, who was a successful poet and painter. By all accounts, they created an extraordinary, if unorthodox, partnership, studying and working together, painting, doing calligraphy, and writing poetry. The show reveals the intimacy of these three arts. Poetry, calligraphy, and painting were skills an enlightened person aspired to perfect. They were known in Chinese and Japanese literati culture as the three perfections. Calligraphy, in its expression of poetry, embodies both language and art and takes on even greater significance, says Felice Fisher.
It's believed that calligraphy, because it's sort of a direct extension of the hand, is an expression of the artist's inner being as well, and that if you're a good calligrapher, you're also a good person, even not only aesthetically, but even morally.
In this exhibition, poetry is translated into English. Hiroyuki Shimatani, director of cultural properties at the Tokyo National Museum, who also co-authored the essay on calligraphy in the book that accompanies the show, says calligraphy can be appreciated also for its own imagery.
Of course, the best way is to appreciate the form as well as the meanings. It might be difficult, not only for Americans, but also for Japanese these days. But the images we can appreciate for their beauty. The audience can trace the artist's psychological feelings or thoughts and track such kind of feelings.
This exhibition is not only the first major U.S. show of Taiga's work, it's the first show anywhere in the world of the work of Gyokuran, who was equally successful in her lifetime, but who is less well known today. Anne Darnincourt says the exhibition is also noteworthy for the works it reunites.
Reunions between works of art by Gyokuran and Taiga, reunions of the suites of work by Taiga, which have not been together maybe even since they left the artist studio.
The 209 pieces in the show include paintings and calligraphy on large screens, hanging scrolls, album and fan paintings, including 12 works designated for special protection by the Japanese government. Hiroyuki Shimatani says this gathering of works would be unusual even in Japan.
It's very difficult to organize this kind of exhibition, to collect many artworks. It probably can't be done in Japan, but because of the reputation of the Philadelphia Museum, they could borrow these.
Although Taiga is best known as one of the leaders of the Nanga, or southern painting movement that emulated a Chinese form of landscape painting, he tried many styles and subjects. The philosophical freedom to buck convention may have started with finger painting, or rather, fingernail painting, as Felice Fisher describes.
It's a very difficult technique because you have to let your fingernail grow and you have to actually move the paper surface around because you don't have the flexibility that you do with a brush. It gave him a chance using a different tool to free himself from the dictates and preconceived ideas of brushwork. But once he sort of felt that he was free to do what he wanted to do, he translated some of those techniques back into brush painting.
The show illustrates the variety in their output. Many works are representations of the familiar subjects of bamboo, orchid, plum, and chrysanthemum. Large landscapes are painted in different styles, some with Chinese subjects and some true view works, which Taiga painted from memory after his travels. And there is also humor. Depictions of goblins, festivals, and humorous figures like the man eating too many sweet potatoes, and the screens that illustrate a song of the great eight drinkers. But a listing of subjects and styles can't really convey the experience of this exhibition. There are beautiful pictures, but there is a sense of entering another zone, another time and place, where the world is seen just a bit differently, where beauty can be uncovered in a majestic mountain, a delicate petal, or the single sweep of a brush dipped in black ink. Ike Taiga and Tokiyama Gyokuran, Japanese Masters of the Brush, runs through July 22nd at the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
WRTI's Susan Lewis.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way.
The 1943 song written by Oscar Hammerstein for the hit Broadway musical Oklahoma. Inspiration for the song didn't come from the sparse prairie of the Great Plains, but from the land around Hammerstein's farmhouse in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. The prolific songwriter was not the only artist inspired by the rustic beauty of Bucks County. The area was a draw for artists of all kinds, among them such luminaries as Dorothy Parker, S.J. Perlman, and Hammerstein's friend James Michener, whose book he adapted for the hit musical South Pacific. Bucks County, like many American exurbs, has changed. Many of the farms have been replaced with subdivisions, where woods once grew, parking lots and shopping malls now stand. There are still glimpses of what made this region attractive. To farmers, the fertile soil. To artists, refuge from the chaos of the city. And then, as it often goes, developers. In the county seat, Doylestown, there's still evidence, though, of what once was. Nestled between highways and strip malls stands a preserved American small town with a hint of a French village. There are shops and cafes and even a thriving cultural centre. Down the hill from the quaint business district is a large castle-like structure housing the Mercer Museum, and across the road stands a sturdy yet somewhat ominous-looking building.
For some time, the county thought they would tear the place down, because, you know, it was a prison, it was a terrible place, it was a medieval dungeon.
But thanks to forward-thinking trends in development, reuse conquered demolition, and the 19th-century prison was tastefully transformed into a 20th-century art museum. The renovated building is a seamless union of stone prison walls and new large glass windows exposing an outdoor sculpture garden. A visitor walking into the museum is greeted with a room dedicated to Michener, with his desk, baseball, and Presidential Medal of Freedom on display. There's also a room set aside for the world-renowned furniture maker George Nakashima, who spent most of his creative years in Bucks County designing modern Japanese-influenced wood furniture. Bruce Katzeff points out that Nakashima's work is displayed in museums around the world, including the Met and MoMA. But this collection is unique because the room was designed by his architect daughter, Mira, and is displayed so close to Nakashima's adopted home. And this is the main purpose of the Michener Art Museum, to collect and display the works of artists who made Bucks County home, and in doing so, capture the essence of the place that inspired their work. One of the most prolific groups of artists to call the area home were the Pennsylvania Impressionists, a group of painters who were active in Bucks County in the late 1800s and early 1900s. A colony of Pennsylvania Impressionists formed in nearby New Hope along the Delaware River, and word of the colony attracted more artists to the region. The main gallery walls have works of such prominent Pennsylvania Impressionists as Edward Redfield and William Lathrop. The subjects of the paintings are nature and small-town landscapes. The irony of this collection of paintings is not lost on director Bruce Katzeff.
50 years from now, one of the only remnants of the beauty of Bucks County may well be our collection, because so much of what those artists were painting back in 1920 and 1930 no longer exists.
Not that the Michener is trying to become a museum dedicated solely to images of Bucks County past. They're building a collection of contemporary art as well. And James Michener would be glad to see that instead of failing, this building with his name on the front is in fact growing. In 2002, an annex to the museum was built in New Hope. Therein is an exhibit devoted to the lives of Bucks County artists. Curator Brian Peter lists some of the subjects.
People like Oscar Hammerstein, Dorothy Parker, S.J. Perelman, Pearl Buck. The visual artists we chose were Edward Hicks, Daniel Garber, Edward Redfield, Charles Sheeler, and writers like Gene Toomer, the great African-American writer. They're figures of real national importance who lived and worked in Bucks County.
But is this creative legacy going away along with the farmland that's being developed? Curator Peterson thinks not.
I would say, as opposed to 100 years ago when the Impressionist painters were here, it's not as cohesive a community of artists. It's much more varied stylistically, and there isn't this sense of a kind of a tight-knit community as there was then when it was much smaller and sort of in simpler times. But there's a lot of very interesting and significant artists that live and work here now, and as I say, in our exhibiting and collecting, we try to honor and focus on that as well as on the historic people.
And you can find a link to the James A. Michener Museum, as well as further information on all our stories, at our website, www.wrti.org. As local theatre communities begin preparations for the beginning of their new season, there's at least one regional enclave that's been going strong all summer long. Now Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at the vibrant theatre scene on the southern tip of New Jersey.
South of Atlantic City, there's not much professional theatre along the shore. In fact, it's virtually non-existent, with the exception of Cape May. Perhaps best known for its ubiquitous Victorian architecture, the beach town is home to two established theater companies. Founded in 1980, the East Lynn Theater Company specializes in producing American stage classics. Gail Stahlhuth is artistic director.
Theater in Cape May is definitely thriving.
The other theater in town, the Cape May Stage, is led by artistic director Michael Carlton. He's also upbeat about the state of theater in Cape May.
For the past 5 years, we've experienced phenomenal growth. We've basically almost doubled our attendance and box office in the past 5 years. And every year we're able to do slightly bigger productions, pay the artists a bit more, and our audience base has steadily increased.
Demonstrated by the success of the Cape May stage and East Lynn, there appears to be an appetite for theater at the shore. But with so few professional theaters along the southern New Jersey coast, how did Cape May come to support two companies? 83-year-old Bruce Minix was mayor of Cape May from 1972 to 1976. The retired television producer, writer, and director remembers the days when movies were about the only form of entertainment in town, besides the beach.
If you had lived here in 1968, when we moved here year-round, it was a desert. We needed something. We needed it for ourselves. And I think that's still one of the factors that's controlling all of this, because the people who move to Cape May and decide they love it and decide they want to stay are generally fairly sophisticated people, and they're used to having good entertainment.
In many cases, cultivating sophistication involves money. And Michael Carlton frankly admits that Cape May tends to attract wealthy residents.
I think people tend to associate, you know, money and culture. I mean, it shouldn't be that way. Everybody should be able to have theater and arts and music and film festivals, but it doesn't really follow.
As a nonprofit organization, Carlton's Cape May stage doesn't generate very much revenue with ticket sales. In fact, like many theaters, over half of the company's budget comes from grants, private donations, and corporate sponsors. Carlton suggests that few vibrant theaters pop up in the region because they need the support of businesses, which aren't in abundance beyond a shore town like Cape May.
A lot of South Jersey is rural and agricultural, so you don't have anybody to pick up the tab.
While attendance numbers are up and donors continue to support the Cape May stage and the East Lynn Company, it is by no means all smooth sailing for the theaters. For years, one of the biggest hurdles has been the lack of venues. In general, artistic performances in the area take place in churches, hotels, and gymnasiums. The Cape May stage is finally in the process of converting an old church into a more conventional theater space, but Gail Stahlhoff says the East Lynn Theater Company, which performs in Cape May's First Presbyterian Church, hasn't had such luck in securing their own space, although they've come close in recent years.
And it's broken my heart several times to come close, but you know, real estate by the shore is very expensive right now. We have not given up. And in the meantime, we've actually had other venues be known to us that are outside of Cape May County and outside of Cape May. And the decision so far from the Board of Trustees of the East Lynn Theater Company is to try to keep finding a place here. So in essence, we have turned down other venues at the risk of staying here and still hoping to find a permanent home.
The difficulty of finding a good performance space is one downside to doing theater in Cape May. However, the nearby beaches and surrounding Victoriana might make up for that inconvenience. Michael Carlton says the shore culture helps to pull in good acting talent from Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, and even the West Coast.
I think a lot of these really, really fine actors come here because they know we do good work and they know they get, you know, their days off at the beach. They had to call me up and say, hey, you got something for me this summer? I'd love to be down at the beach for the summer. And I'm in a really lucky position that I know a lot of good actors who do want to come here and work for much less than they're worth.
While the beach and Victoriana make Cape May an easy sell during July and August, former Mayor Bruce Minix says town leaders long ago recognized that in order for Cape May to thrive, they needed to find ways to draw visitors outside the traditional beach season.
A big element of that, of course, is the theater.
Indeed, the Cape May theater seasons extend from May to December. In conjunction with events like Victorian Week and a film festival in the fall, the theaters proved to be assets for Cape May. But Michael Carlton notes it's not realistic to think of theater as being a primary incentive for most people to visit, for now.
Down in the shore, it's still the beaches, and in Cape May, the Victoriana. But I think we're beginning to be part of the reason people come. And I want to position the arts and my theater in particular, as a reason people get here.
Cape May Stage Artistic Director Michael Carlton, ending that report by WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Franz Schubert's Die Forelle, a performance by Marian Anderson from January of 1951. No one would question the idea that Marian Anderson was, in the traditional original sense of the word, truly a diva. Yet in her own South Philadelphia neighborhood, she was best known for her modesty. When Anderson would return to Philadelphia after touring the world, she would still sing in her local church choir and take an active interest in her neighborhood. Anderson made a huge impact on one little girl in particular in that South Philadelphia neighborhood.
When she'd come home from her tours, she'd have my mother bring me up here, and she would chat with me. Little Blanche, how are things going? What are you playing now?
Blanche Burton Lyles is a concert pianist and founder and president of the Marian Anderson Historical Society. Lyles bought Marian Anderson's house in 1997 and opened it to visitors. Lyles' mother was the pianist at the Union Baptist Church, where a young Marian Anderson first began singing. Members of the congregation immediately realized that Anderson's voice was so extraordinary it would merit a fund to support her formal training. This fund would ultimately pay for Anderson to train with private teachers in the US and Europe. On her return from Europe, Anderson began a path that would eventually lead to international stardom. In 1924, she bought a home on South Martin Street in South Philadelphia, directly across the street from the church where she had started singing. Phyllis Sims is curator of the Marian Anderson House.
This house she purchased for her mother in 1924, and together they lived here for over 60 years. And this is where she stayed, you know, when she came to Philadelphia.
Late in her life, Anderson married architect Orpheus King Fisher, whom she had befriended when she was 15. Fisher designed the paneling in the parlor room of the house. Visitors to the parlor can peruse photographs of Anderson with Albert Einstein, Paul Robeson, and assorted dignitaries. But as Phyllis Sims walks us through the house, she explains that Anderson did most of her entertaining not in her parlor, but in her basement.
It was fashionable for blacks to fix up their basements because, you know, they weren't allowed to the various restaurants and things during that period. And this is what we call the Marian Anderson Entertainment Center. At the time, of course, there was a bar and table and sofas and chairs.
On the wall in the basement is a photo of Marian Anderson singing to a large crowd at the Lincoln Memorial on what is perhaps her most famous day.
She was in demand, and her concerts had been a sellout. So when she came back here and Howard University tried to find a hall suitable, they said, well, Constitution Hall would be great for the concert. Of course, they didn't allow her to sing there. They had never had a black there, and they weren't about to make an exception. And since Eleanor Roosevelt was a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, who were the keepers of Constitution Hall, resigned, she used her political influence and worked with the Department of Interior, decided they would have it at the Lincoln Memorial and have it open for everyone.
Point, the National Broadcasting Company brings you a song recital by the gifted Marian Anderson, considered by music critics throughout the world as possessing a most outstanding contralto voice.
We are grateful to Miss Marian Anderson for coming here to sing to us today.
And besides the Marian Anderson Historical Residence and Museum, the great singer is also remembered in her native city by the annual prize bestowed on great artist humanitarians. The 2007 Marian Anderson Award will be presented to the actor and human rights activist Richard Gere at a ceremony in the fall. And that's it for now. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.